It is Saturday, October 10th, 2015. We are broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Bonnie Primsch, and with me in the studio is Miles Elam, political junkie and software engineer. Hello, Miles.
Hello.
And Lyle Troxell, software engineer, maker, and family man.
Hello, Bonnie.
Hey, Lyle. Lots to talk about today. I want to start with some updates and corrections and that sort of thing. Let's start with chip and pin. This is something that I came across in Spain, Miles, because people would ask us, do you have chip and pin on your credit card or you just have the magnetic stripe? And I just had the stripe and my man
had the pin. And as an American,
you
go, the what and the huh?
That was a huh? Yeah, and I will admit, though I survived through that whole trip in Spain, I'm still not totally clear on the chip and pin thing.
All right, same thing happened to me when I was visiting in England a few years back. Chip and pin is that new gold square that appears on the ATM and credit cards coming out these days.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might ask, you know, what's the difference? Why does it matter there's a chip instead of a stripe? Well, the stripe, if you don't know already, is actually just the magnetic encoding of your credit card number and the expiration date. It's exactly what it appears on the front of your card. That's why it's so easy to clone and so easy to have identity theft and fraudulent charges on it. The chip, on the other hand, is something you might think of as its own microcontroller.
Mm-hmm.
Where when you plug that into the machine, there's a computer inside the terminal.
Mm-hmm.
And that is going to have a two-way communication with that chip. And they're going to use a public key, private key encryption scheme for that. Meaning that even if someone were listening to that conversation, they couldn't just replay the conversation at another terminal. It doesn't work that way.
Hmm. Well, that sounds more secure and better, although sometimes when you talk to vendors, they seem to have a different attitude about this thing coming. I ate in a cafe in Scotts Valley a few weekends ago, and they did sort of like a big, a whole heavy sigh explanation about how they needed us to trot around and write our tip down before they ran the card because of chip and pin. These things are installed and they're a hassle.
Well, the thing is, most vendors won't have you type in the PIN. The PIN is usually to protect against someone using the card away from human activity.
Mm-hmm.
It's to establish that you are the one that has that card, and it's going to be used at kiosks, you know, unmanned kiosks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in France, when you have a card and a chip and pin card, the restaurateur comes to you and you take the device from them. It's normally handheld. And you put your card in and pull it out and put your pin in and approve the amount of money. That's where the tip thing comes from.
Right.
And then you hand it off back to them. So at no point does the card actually go to the person's hands. You keep it and you keep the pin. And I'm assuming in our restaurant situations, we're not necessarily doing that. We're not carrying those things around.
They're used to having their card reader right at the cash register next to them. I'm not sure how many
right.
of these are going to be portable handheld devices and how much are going to stay in
for the
place.
Time being, and also for custom's sake, like that's what people are used to. They're going to take the card. They're going to put it in their machine. And they're not going to take the use the PIN portion of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically how it's turning out here. Now, a little wrinkle here is these chip-enabled cards that we have, a lot of them don't work overseas.
What?
They're not a worldwide standard.
What do you mean? Like the one, they already have it in Europe and, as our Canadian correspondent is bragging, in Canada. But you're saying that the ones that are being created over here for now are not going to work in those places?
I'm saying the ones in Europe are Mac and we are PC.
Oh, how awkward.
And yeah, so it is definitely an improvement. It's definitely an improvement over you have this magnetic reader that just lists what your card number is.
But why aren't they going to this? I don't understand that. I don't understand that because you'd think when corporations think about themselves first, you'd think about their own convenience would mean that their credit cards would work in the United States the same as they would in Europe or elsewhere where chip and PIN already exists. Who decided it was a good idea to have a slightly different chip and PIN?
Is it a software bug or a design problem by government? Like, which one is it?
Oh, it's not government. If anyone is to blame, it's going to be MasterCard and Visa.
Okay, so it's proprietary nonsense between companies.
So government charter, not government, because a corporation is a government charter.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, God. We're going to talk a little later about how corporations are once again ruining our lives.
Yeah, that may improve over time, but for now, don't be too surprised when you go overseas and something doesn't work.
Okay. Well, I guess more on the rollout, as there are hilarious snags. But meanwhile...
Oh, and also don't expect, even though all businesses were supposed to have the chip and PIN interface, and when you go to the grocery store, like, for example, I go to my local Safeway, it has the chip and PIN, and I put it in, and they tell me, yeah, it doesn't work yet. You need to slide your card.
Oh.
And that's going to be the case. Even though it was supposed to be done by October 1st, expect some lag, but it probably will improve within a year, because after a certain period of time, Visa, MasterCard, and the others are going to start charging the company the fraud amount if something goes wrong, if they're not using the most up-to-date method, which is the chip.
Okay. All right.
And this rollout is actually in alignment with Google Wallet and specifically Apple Pay.
Apple Pay.
All being able to do this via your phone, via the innards of your phone. And I mean, over a year ago, I had an Android phone that had support for this, and I was able to pay at like Pete's Coffee, no problem. Mm-hmm. And with my iPhone now that I'm doing iOS, I'm also able to pay in a lot of places. It's darn convenient. I love that idea of it. And it's interesting. I wonder if chip and PIN will never actually be successful in the U.S. and we'll just supersede it with phones.
If it'll be some sort of...
Betamax.
Some
I stole the words
out
of your mouth.
Interim technology that we do while we figure ourselves out. Okay. Well, more on that later. Meanwhile, there's been interesting developments in the world of the self-driving car. There are other companies getting in on the fun.
Yes. Daimler is testing a self-driving mass-produced truck, and they're testing it on the Autobahn.
When you say truck, you don't mean pickup truck, you mean like truck?
I mean shipping truck, yes.
Shipping truck? Ooh, okay.
One of those trucks that can run you over and kill you?
The ones that are really heavy when they're full of stuff?
But when you think about it, on the highway is an easier problem. When you get onto a freeway, most of the cars are going at about the same speed. You don't have bicyclists and pedestrians crossing in all likelihood.
Look out, little Billy. but you do have Autobahn speeds and very heavy trucks.
Yes. But so as I said, the problem is simpler. It's not like going through a community and having to worry about, you know, the little kid running out in the middle of the street.
Well, okay. And so you heard about this on Engadget. Is everything going well with their testing of the self-driving map-produced truck?
Well, I'm pretty sure if it wasn't going well, we would have heard about it.
Yeah, okay.
In my limited experience in driving other countries, I've got to say the Autobahn in Germany is... The roads are in beautiful condition. I mean, there's great signage. You know, smooth sailing. Everything's marked really well. So I can imagine that that's a situation where a robotic vehicle would work really well, right? Because, there's always going to be a divider line. Yeah, there's always going to be a white line that splits before, whatever the colors were, I can't recall. But I can definitely imagine a very structured road system being a perfect place for something like this. Additionally, I would assume at first there'll be people in the vehicle, just one driver. And during the normal, commute times or normal times when the road's in good condition, everything, that driver can go to sleep in the back and then wake up and deal with problems if they arise. Pretty cool.
They don't have to take as much speed.
That's right. Not as much. the job note is fun.
Fewer, less speed. More likely likelihood of being alive maybe at the end when nobody's driving. Kind of sad. All right. And
except Will Smith. He always goes into manual.
Okay. I didn't get that reference.
iRobot. Yes.
He goes into manual.
He doesn't trust the computers, so he goes into manual and drives the car himself.
Oh, okay. Right. He was sort of like the Luddite of that movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
At which point everyone says, you're driving it manually at these speeds? Are you crazy? Anyway, moving on.
Did you see the movie, Bonnie?
It's been a while.
Yeah.
I don't have the photographic memory of all the lines.
I think us geeks went, no, the computers will be better. You will die. But of course, it's an action film, so he does better.
It's not about that. Yeah.
Actually, he crashes.
Yeah, as you would.
So I've been meaning to get on to the next segment for a few asides, so I'm just going to do that now.
Enrico Fermi, physicist Enrico Fermi. Mm-hmm. Do you know who he is?
The name Fermi is familiar.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure why. Fermi...
Quantum theory?
Get it? Familiar.
Is it going to be like that all show, Miles?
Quantum theory, nuclear and particle physicist, statistical mechanics, really good physicist, amazing. His career was in the 40s and 50s.
Okay.
He passed away in the mid-1950s, I believe. Yep. Anyway, he has what's known as the Fermi paradox.
Oh, and that's what I've heard of.
Yes.
But I don't remember why I've heard
of it. Okay, so you've looked up the night sky on a clear and dark day evening.
Yes.
And seen a beautiful amount of stars.
Yeah.
Pretty much all the stars you see are actually local. They're really local to us. But the galaxies go on and on and on.
Yeah.
And Fermi looked up and said, where are all the peoples? With the general idea is, if all of those stars are suns, there should be a lot of other races of species and such outside of our own solar system.
Okay.
And so that's the paradox. If there's so many stars, and it seems like life is pretty, would be abundant potentially, of course we don't really know that, then there should be just a mass amount of communication. We should see representation of civilization every direction we look.
And, okay. So
but
that's...
we don't.
Yeah, based on how it happens here on Earth, where we just go and like spew our signal out into the universe and it just kind of wanders around.
So Edward Snowden, now you know who Edward Snowden is, right?
I'm aware of Edward Snowden, yes.
He's an American computer professional, former CIA employee, and former and NSA, but also the CIA.
Was CIA?
Yes.
No, it was just NSA.
No, CIA as well. Former government contractor who leaked classified information to the U.S. National Security NSA documentation, and of course has revolutionized how we think about security and privacy, and has been a big advocate of better government regulation on what we can and cannot do to our people. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he kind of answered the paradox question with it, with something I've actually heard before, but he said it very succinctly and well, and basically says, if you look at encrypted communication, if these other civilizations out there exist and they're encrypting their data to transport it back and forth, it would look from a distance like noise. In fact, the whole idea of encryption is that you can't get any information or knowledge out of the post-encrypted stuff. Mm-hmm. So when you visit a website that's your bank website and it's via SSL, the actual communication system, the data, if you look at it, looks like noise. Looks like it's just part of the background radiation of the universe, if you will.
Huh.
So his perspective is, well, obviously only very immature species don't encrypt their data. And the other aspect of this that makes a lot of sense is when you think about listening to another solar system and thinking about trying to get data from them, you also have to assume that they're just blowing out a lot of extra energy they don't actually need. Because if we're going to communicate from, like, I don't know, Los Gatos to Ben Lomond, the amount of power we need to do that is pretty minuscule.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens to be that our television stations have been broadcasting, as everyone knows, they go out, and there's lots of wonderful sci-fi about other alien races listening to our signals and coming and visiting.
Right? Yeah, they're all big fans of I Love Lucy.
Exactly, right. They're all back in time to some degree. And, of course, that is actually basically just because it was immature technology. And as the maturity increases with our technology, we get less and less noisy, and noise is kind of fun, and our signals look like noise. So that's Snowden's perspective of the solution to the paradox, to Fermi's old paradox.
Huh. Well, that's interesting. Miles, what do you think of that? Does it hold water?
Well, that's something that people have been talking about, that one of the things has not just been whether or not they are a coherent signal, but whether the output from different solar systems, the energy output, matches there being a civilization. And so there is some back and forth on that, especially because a more advanced race would be more efficient in their communication. They wouldn't necessarily use radio. They might use point-to-point lasers, which we wouldn't be able to see unless the laser was pointed at us.
But wouldn't we still see some of their old signals before they got their act together?
Radio signals just don't travel well enough in terms of the vast distances of space.
Oh, okay. Fascinating.
I mean, it is possible that there's blips of civilizations that go for 50 years and are noisy, like we have been, right, for the last 50 years.
Yeah.
But 50 years does not make a lot of density with regards to the galaxy, right?
Like, I guess not. Well, if you're looking at the,
would be pretty quick.
You know, gaping maw of space, then yeah.
You have to find the right time.
Huh. Fascinating. Okay. Well, do we have time for one quick update about something very speedy that has happened?
Well, Speedy?
Yes.
Well, I was actually going to suggest that we do a little bit of a correction, if you don't mind.
All right, let's do that.
We had Professor Phil Deutschle from Hartnell College and from Salinas High write in about last week's show, and that was that Andromeda is not our closest galaxy. He writes, it's just the most distant thing you can be seen with a naked human unaided eye. And he said it more better than that. The large and small Magellanic clouds are closer and visually brighter, but only viewed from the southern hemisphere. Altogether, there are about 24 galaxies closer to us than Andromeda. So I misspoke last week, and thank you, Phil, so much for correcting us.
Although technically they're satellite galaxies of the Milky Way and Andromeda, so I don't know if they really count.
Okay, well,
ooh, touche.
This may begin now. The debate with Phil Deutschle of Hartnell College. Thanks for letting us know, Phil. By the way, you're listening to Geek Speak here on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch. With me is Miles Elam and Lyle Troxell. And when we come back, we're going to have a discussion about ethics and engineering. So do stay tuned. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch here with Lyle Troxell and Miles Elam. And you can join us online on Twitter or Facebook. We are KUSP Geeks, and we'd love to hear from you. If you have questions or corrections for us, as Phil did, reach out to us online, KUSP Geeks. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP. And usually at this part of the show, we have a little deeper discussion about kind of a big picture topic in geekery. And this week, it's the ethics of engineering, basically. When someone has an idea and wants to bring it into the world, how responsible is that person for considering the impact of what is being brought into the world? Should engineers be responsible for so much of our world, as I would argue they currently are, much to my frustration when I try to figure out iTunes, for instance? Do they have the responsibility to make sure that what they're doing is going to add to the greater good? What do you guys think?
As a software engineer, what do I think?
Yeah, yeah.
I think as a human being, I have a responsibility to have my actions minimalistically negatively affect society and potentially benefit society. I think that's one of the reasons why I volunteer for this show,
yeah,
to help kind of share knowledge.
Right.
But as an engineer, are you responsible in that regard? I don't know. Miles, what do you thought?
I think so. It depends upon what you're working on, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And software engineering is usually not the same as general engineering, hardware.
Right.
Because if you mess up on an elevator, people die. If you mess up on a chat app, chances are people are going to live through it.
But if you mess up on a security system...
Yes, if you mess up on the security of a mail program, for example, and your mail program just happens to be Gmail, then that leaves people open to, I don't know, dissidents being killed in a country.
Yeah, there can be life and death.
I remember when you were working at Google, and at one point you said, yeah, we have to take security seriously, because if people get into the data that we have, people can die. Because dissidents, for example, is a great example. Like somebody that's trying to be outspoken and the government doesn't like it. Mm-hmm. If they're found out, they can get killed. But even at a lighter level than that, the responsibility we see for software engineers to make systems that protect us, the side effects of them doing bad jobs definitely negatively affects us in great ways. There was this interesting article by Ben Adia, and I won't read the entire thing, but I want to read one of his quotes, and I thought this would be a good place for us to talk a little bit about it, because, of course, one perspective is, who cares what software engineers do, you know? But listen to his stance.
Yeah.
We software engineers have superpowers most people don't remotely understand. The trust society places in us is growing so rapidly that the only thing that looks even remotely similar is the trust placed in doctors, except most people have a pretty good idea of the trust they're placing in the doctor, while they have almost no idea that every time they install an app, enter some personal data, or share a private thought in a private electronic conversation, they're trusting a set of software engineers who have very little in the form of ethical guidance. Because that is true that doctors, part of their training is to have ethical classes, to have to have an understanding of what they should be doing.
Biomedical ethics is an aspect of what people learn. And it sounds like there might not be the similar sort of thing in a potential engineer's studies. And it also sounds like there is not always an ethical code set by large companies that hire engineers.
Absolutely.
Another of our geeks, Brian, pointed out a blog post from Ash Furrow, who had learned recently that Google does not have a designated ethicist, as she writes, but instead relies on each individual engineer to make ethical decisions. I'm making an assumption that Ash Furrow is a lady person. I don't actually know. And so that led Ash to think about, okay, well now, if it's up to the individual engineer to make those ethical decisions, let's just look at another example at what happened at Volkswagen when, you know, the cheating about vehicle emissions seems to have been done on a massive scale, at least since 2009, and not one engineer stood up or made a peep anywhere to indicate that there were shenanigans going on. So perhaps we should not rely on the engineers to be the ethical, what, gatekeepers?
Yeah. On the flip side, if you think about, say, something like Facebook, which is now a very important part of many people's lives, or at least very intrusive part of most people's lives, Facebook is, what, barely 10 years old? And so how do you define ethical guidelines for something that hasn't existed yet? And that's the big dilemma that comes into play. How do you make the decisions about how people are going to interact in a social network before the social network exists, before the specific feature exists, before a like exists?
I mean, to take that a little bit further, we've spoke about this on the show before. The idea of actually being able to communicate what the settings are for privacy regarding Facebook is so complex because we actually don't have that kind of complexity in our everyday language. We have friends, we have acquaintances. We don't have like a friend that we want them to see pictures of our kids versus a friend that we don't want to have see pictures of our kids.
I vehemently disagree. I believe we do have those. Yeah. It's just that they are learned over the course of our lives. They're learned over the course of many generations, and they're learned in the course of nonverbal communication along with verbal communication and who you choose to be friends with.
Perhaps I misspoke. What I'm saying is we don't have language to describe those things. We have an understanding societally what is close and what's not. But when you try to codify it, you have to communicate it in some structured form. And to do that, you have to use language. And we just don't have the vocabulary necessary to handle this complexity.
We don't have Eskimo for snow type complexity.
That's my argument, at least. And of course, when we actually codify that as software engineers, we definitely have language to do that. But the complexity is so great that we can't have an informed, educated society debate about it. But
is that true? Because aren't there think tanks, for instance, the Institute for the Future, which have been making a point of trying to anticipate the way the world is going and think about, you know, well, what sort of a structure and envelope can we put around there? How can we prepare?
Yes. And in addition to that, we've also had philosophers for millennia talking about what is right or wrong. And yet many societies and many groups and tribal groups do not subscribe to those.
Well, so then that just reminds me of, for instance, World War II. Scientists are developing powerful energy sources, which can also be weapons. You know, who was responsible for making sure that they were developing something that would be handled responsibly when Hiroshima is a thing that can happen? So, I mean, is this sort of the same then kind of question?
We've gotten into a hole of ethics. I mean,
whenever you talk about nuclear weapons, that tends to kind of overshadow a conversation. When I think of social interaction, the social interaction, for example, in a barbershop or a social interaction you would expect if you are in the field of dance or theater is going to be different from when you are a software engineer or when you are a traffic cop. You know, like all these things where we have social interactions have different contexts and different behavior and different mannerisms and different expectations. And one of the drawbacks to something like Facebook or Friendster or MySpace before it, it was that you are homogenizing all of these social constructs. All of the expectations that people had is these different tribes are now being mashed together in unexpected ways.
And when you know, some are incomprehensible to others, I'm thinking about Brian's discussion a couple weeks ago about just how detailed the work is that goes into engineering and how then difficult it is to explain to others. So then that gets us to the conversation last week when now he's trying to explain to his parents how things work and You know, it's just going to work for them to just do rote stuff, because trying to explain the underlying concepts is all but impossible.
And there's also this neutrality that exists in the tech area where the engineers are just doing very clear things, right? And therefore, there's not an ethical question here. We're just implementing this code. Code is law. Like the idea that we have to think about the ethical ramifications of what's happening does not necessarily enter into the day to day.
Yeah.
Because the truth is, well, if you don't like the product, don't use it. It's not like it's going to stop food from getting on your table.
Yeah.
But as we get more and more embedded in our society, based off of these things that are codified that way, it definitely affects us. It definitely affects us as a species.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that the engineer has this great knowledge and that therefore there's like this power point there is something that's been bothering me for a while. There is this level in our society that people that can code and understand technology have a leg up on understanding what's happening in the world
mm-hmm.
that other people don't have. And that to me is uncomfortable. I don't like that idea. I want everyone to be able to understand how the world works.
But do we all understand how our cars work? We drive them.
Well, I understand how our cars work, but I think a car is a very, very different thing than a network that manages all our information and communication. A car gets you from point A to point B. There's a lot of complexity in it and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of being able to mitigate and modify and inter-slice communication is a very different type of thing. It is, you can control the world if you manage communications effectively. And that's a lot of power.
There's also the aspect of, when using your car analogy, of the car is an extension of the person. It really is how mm-hmm. people think of it. You're on the road. It's part of you.
Mm-hmm.
And you interact with other people driving a car. So it's still a human interaction, even though you are encased in a big steel and glass bubble. When you're talking about software is fundamentally the application or the practical application of logic, mathematics, you know, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And human beings are not logical or intuitive mathematicians. It's something that has to be learned and trained. And as elections year after year show, it's not something that in general people do learn. Even the smartest among us are driven by our emotions with regard to our social interactions. So when you're mapping human behavior, which is very much pattern recognition and emotion based,
mm-hmm.
to a system that is strictly logical, except when you are using that math and logic to try to simulate an emotional response in which hilarity ensues, that's where I think you really get this mismatch and why the ethical issues become so difficult, because you're trying to map to a human sense of justice something that is ambivalent or orthogonal to that.
Well, it all leads me to think, all right, well, if engineers are just coding away, doing their thing, and are focusing on the project at hand and not on its impact, then who is responsible for considering that impact?
Good question. I don't think there is one. There's not an overseeing type.
There's
but
not an overseeing
I also
type.
Don't want to say that all engineers are like that, right? When we have,
no, of course not.
We have Wikipedia, right, for an example, right? That is
right.
a software engineer solution to sharing all world knowledge.
Right.
That's amazing.
Like, that is amazing.
That is a gift to society, a gift to the humans. And that's done by a software engineer, a group of people, right?
Yeah.
That are all very engineer beasts. So there's amazing things that come out too. But then there's examples of people.
P-E-E-P-L-E, right?
Yeah, this project, which was launched on September 30th, well, became widespread knowledge on September 30th
It has not
article.
Been launched.
No. And the article from Washington Post has the title is, "Everyone You Know Will Be Able to Rate You on the Terrifying Yelp for People." And if you know Yelp, it's the thing that you can do restaurant reviews. There's also things that do professor reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And in general, these are online services that allow you to rate things, give stars, give photographs, talk about the pluses and the minuses. Very useful when you're in a strange town, you want to know where the good restaurant is.
And gameable. I mean, if you think about Yelp, you also think about how frustrating it is for people who just choose to put up like a revenge review that doesn't really have anything to do with the actual quality of the service provided.
Programmatically bringing us all back to eighth grade.
Yes.
And so, people is the, you can rate individuals,
Well, and that's how it was originally designed.
Yeah, and it sounds completely creepy and horrible.
Yeah.
And the truth is that the things like Rate My Professor, there's been lots of studies on it. Rate My Professor, if you're in college and you want to know what your professor's like, you can go up to this place called Rate Your Professor, and other students have written about the professor. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the data and you actually do studies on it, professors who students consider attractive are more likely to be given high ratings, mm-hmm. and there are completely different ratings stats and different traits that are rated against for men and for women professors. So it is a sexist and probably very
it's got all kind of human flaws.
Oh, it's horrible.
Well, and also there's mention that, you know, things like that, if you look at the data, say more about the people doing the rating than the people that are being rated.
Absolutely. Absolutely, they do.
So now here's the People app, which
hasn't launched yet and probably will get killed, I hope.
Launched yet, and which the founders had something in mind when they founded it. And if you look at the Snopes write-up about this, is very fascinating because it's not a straight-ahead hoax.
You know, by the way, Snopes.com is awesome.
That's another really good thing. Put it,
when you hear a crazy thing on the internet and you're thinking, is that true? Go to Snopes.com and do a search for it. Mm-hmm. And you found, so they have an article about people.
Yeah, and apparently there's all kinds of problems with, well, how serious were these founders? Because it on one hand, it looks more like it's about the reality show about developing the app than the actual app. And then when the Washington Post wrote about their application, like 3 days before that, there was very little information on the web about this app being developed, though the founders were all over the media getting attention. And now, shortly after all of this negative attention, oh my God, that's a terrible idea, they are drastically changing the purpose of the app, although it has been described in a variety of ways over its existence. So it becomes a confusing example in one sense, because is this thing really going to happen? But I think it does point out just how easy it is to develop pretty far into an idea before considering the ethical questions that they bring up.
I mean, the other thing that's amazing about the Snopes article, about this Washington Post article about the app People, which wasn't launched yet, mm-hmm. was that the Snopes article, half of what it's doing is referring to things that have changed in the Washington Post article.
Yeah.
Meaning that as more stuff got, you know, in learned, the article gets changed. So when you read the Washington Post article versus when I read it, it got modified on the fly.
Right.
Which is not how we think about journalism. But right. That's how it works now.
That's how it works now. There's updates.
And half of the discussion about it is about the discussion about it, right?
That
so
meta
thing is very common in our society.
And what many of us learned in terms of looking up sources, going to a local newspaper and going down to the basement and looking at old copies, or going to the library and looking up old copies. When you can change an article on the fly as it's live, it really does change the nature of what do you do about old news? How do you research old information?
Well, then there's just the ethics of marking those changes, which can get us into a whole other conversation.
I also find the idea that in a society where we rate people, and Facebook does this as well in some regards, in the sense that how many people are connected with you, what does it mean to live in a world where all of your data and everything you do gets documented and petrified into data networks so that you can never really modify who you are or start anew or, you know, apologize to people and move on? Mm-hmm. You kind of always exist in this kind of odd public way. Does that make a society where everybody has to be extremely protective about being free to speak their mind, free to engage in who they are?
Well, we're all going to be trained on what to say publicly and what not to say publicly. Another aspect of this that I found interesting is that, you know, the Ash Furrow blog post expressed some disappointment that, for instance, Google did not have a designated ethicist. This person seemed to be thinking that
I'm actually surprised.
At the corporate level, there should be some sort of ethical consideration. And, you know, that's easier to do when you're an independent engineer, like the developer of Peace, the ad blocker that felt
Marco Arment.
Yeah. And so, you know, he's one guy, so he can say, you know what, I'm just not going to do this anymore. But when you're a corporation, it's harder to make those in the moment decisions. And frankly, this is a conversation that we could continue after we come back. You're listening to Geek Speak here on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Premsch with Miles Elam and Lyle Troxell. And we'll be right back. Don't go away. You're listening to Geek Speak here on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Primsch, speaking with Lyle Troxell and Miles Elam. And before the break, we tucked into the big picture question of what about engineering and ethics and who's taking care of how these things land? And when we left off, Lyle, we just mentioned Marco Arment.
Yeah, Marco Arment is a software developer. He actually was one of the core members of Tumblr, the blog posting system. He was a server engineer for that. Mm-hmm. And then after that, he created a few things. One of them is Instapaper, which became a very popular iOS app, which allowed you to basically save the website you're on to later read it, kind of an offline reading and collecting of data. Mm-hmm. He has a podcast called the Accidental Tech Podcast with John Syracuse, and I'm blanking on one of the other core people. We won't get into that.
We could link to it.
Yeah, and I'll have it in a second. I'll remember him in a second. In any case, Marco is a very successful software engineer who launches his own apps, and he gets to do exactly what he wants in a lot of ways. When iOS 9 came out, prior to iOS 9 coming out, the most recent operating system from Apple, Apple made an announcement at the WWDC that they would add the ability for the browser, the Safari browser in iOS, to have an ad blocker. Miles, do you want to describe what an ad blocker does?
It just checks to see usually if an image or media, it could be in the past Flash content, is coming from a different domain, usually if it's loading in some script, executable JavaScript from another site, and goes, oh, that looks like something from a known source, or something that's clearly not from the same page that you're looking at, so I'm going to fail to load it. Basically tell the browser, kill that connection. Mm-hmm. And the effect is that you end up not having that image of that ad load up, or that video, or the tracking cookie.
Mm-hmm. And that seems like just 100% good thing. Although it sounds like when Marco Arment developed his approach to ad blocking, that he was troubled about some of the choices that caused him to have to make.
What's amazing, by the way, Casey Less, Marco Arment, and John Syracuse talk about this on Accidental Tech Podcast. The reason I know about Marco is because of his app, Overcast, which is a great iOS app for podcasting. Oh. I should have been following along on that. But his whole discussion about this has been very interesting, very meta. So he wanted to put the ad blocker out there called Peace, and that was the first day that iOS happened. It very quickly became the most popular paid app on the App Store, which means he was making thousands and thousands of dollars. He's independently wealthy in some regards. He was a developer, so he doesn't actually need that kind of money. Mm-hmm. And within 24 hours, he pulled the app down, and Apple actually has reimbursed everybody. But during that time, there's a lot of turmoil and such. And what he said in his discussion, I've read a post of his and also listened to the podcast, was basically the issue of ad blocking, because of the way magazines right now, newspapers, are making their money and paying their journalists because of ads. They have for a long time. Mm-hmm. And the online ad space is very challenging to do that successfully. Google, of course, dominates in the ad market. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of power struggles there. New empires have been formed over this.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of opinions about tracking and advertising. Showing ads and tracking are actually synonymous in some ways. It's very hard to disentangle those things.
Yeah, they want to track your general interests so they can provide ads that are relevant to you and not clutter your page with ads that you don't care about, but then a lot of people don't click on those ads anyway,
right.
So then who makes the money?
And in general, an ad that's on a website about shoes is an ad for people that like shoes, and therefore right away, they know you a little bit. So there's a little bit of, it's unclear what tracking is versus what advertising is. So there's a lot of energy around the space, and what Marco saw is that all of a sudden he became the leader in that space, and he didn't like that area. He didn't want to be known for that. He didn't want to participate in that. So he pulled out not because he couldn't make money. He could make a lot of money being there, but because he didn't want to be in a situation where that's who he was known as, and that's what he did. He didn't want to be that person.
What was it about being that? What person was he concerned about being that he didn't want to be that person?
Well, he doesn't. So the space of ad blocking is really uncomfortable. Some people need the ads. People don't like ads.
Yeah.
There's security. And so when you play in that field, you have to be opinionated and expertise and engage in that debate. And he doesn't like that whole debate. He doesn't want to be a part of that. I'm summarizing and speaking for somebody else, of course, but it's what I've surmised from what he's been saying.
So, for instance, an end user could say, well, I don't want the ads, so ad blocker is just 100% win for me. Then I don't have to look at ads.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, small business person who paid for some ads, which would be on a website, even theirs doesn't get on versus the, you know, big bad corporation or the potentially spammy, scammy.
Yeah. It's just not a fun space to be in. Okay. You know, it's and there's a lot of places where technology people can make money, right? You can get into the porn industry and spin up a website and make money there too. But a lot of engineers decide not to do that. And he's one of the people who decides not to do that. He also didn't want to do this space. He also recently talked about podcasting in general. And I thought one of the things he said was beautiful. And that is that the reason he actually developed this Overcast app was this podcasting app was because he's concerned about the idea of some large corporation owning podcasting. Podcasting right now is a very free form anybody can publish. And that flexibility allows, it's a true democracy of will, if you will, rather than if iTunes, for example, only let certain people get into that place. Right. It would be a very different network. So it's a really, his discussion has a really great discussion on this podcast called Core Intuition, talking about iOS development, and they chatted about this, and I just listened to it, and I thought that his opinion about making sure that podcasting stays free and open and non-controlled is very noble. I like that a lot.
Mm-hmm. Gee, do you think we can link to that particular episode of his podcast?
I will link to that episode of the podcast. Also, it really hit a nerve with me because of some changes we made here at Geekspeak recently.
Yeah, we're making a decision about where our podcast can be accessed from.
Yeah.
That has an effect on how many people get to us.
Potentially. I mean, I wish that I'd mentioned this last week before I changed everything, but if you're listening to Geekspeak still, it means the transition from hosted to NPR podcast versus hosted independently succeeded. If you're not listening to Geekspeak, then you're not hearing my voice, and that's too bad. But I did transition everybody over, so I hope there was no hiccups. Please let me know if there were a hiccup of a positive nature in the sense that you're still listening. Or if you had to find us again somehow, please do let us know. We'd love to hear that. Geeks@geekspeak.org.
Perhaps at some point we can put helpful tips on how to get to us at our website, geekspeak.org. But, you know, that does remind me of, you know, the other way this can go, Amazon thinking about its bottom line, needing to take care of its shareholders, is making an interesting decision about what it is allowed to be sold on Amazon. Apple TV? Not being sold on Amazon.
Right. Amazon,
Google Chromecast, not being sold on Amazon, but Prime Video is, which is an Amazon product.
Right. There's like the Amazon Fire TV stick, Amazon Fire TV. There's Apple TV. There's Chromecast. There's Roku. There's many different ways of displaying content. One thing that I had noticed years ago when I got my first Google Chromecast was that it didn't have Amazon Prime Video, which I had been watching on my phone, on my tablet. Some people have said in the past, well, it's because on the laptop they use Flash for handling their DRM, and that's why the video doesn't show there. But that doesn't hold water because on iOS, the iPhone, the iPad, there is no Flash to be able to use there. Adobe's technology doesn't work there.
So you're doubting it's for a technical reason?
Yeah. But that's fine. That's Amazon's choice. I just figured it was a... you know, competition between groups that Amazon isn't going to put it onto Chromecast because that competes with them, and especially with Google's movies, Google Play.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, Amazon has now made this move where they're not even going to sell Apple TV or Google Chromecast on their marketplace, which seems like a very different thing. It's not just, oh, this is what devices we choose to support. It's they're making an active decision to take something off the market. Because essentially, I mean, when you're talking about online commerce, Amazon is...
It is online commerce. Yeah. All roads lead to Amazon in some sense if you're talking about online commerce. So on the one hand, you know, every business should be free to make the decisions they want to make to, you know, support their business. But there's... Amazon almost extends beyond a mere business to a public square, to, you know, part of the social fabric.
Yeah.
And then they are more than just their own private corporation.
It's been exciting to me to see boutique online stores showing up, right? Other online stores actually making a stance.
Yeah.
But nothing is compared to the mass size of Amazon.
Right.
And to think that all of a sudden major things are not available because of, you know, deciding to sell or what not to sell, but because of a secondary service, their streaming service, deciding what they're going to do by selling, is really... interesting tack for them to make. I'm surprised they're doing it. It makes me want to reinvest my time and energy on finding other places to buy things.
Hmm. Well, I wonder if this is going to be the sort of decision that stays after the internet has its way with it, or if it will get chewed up by social media, encouraging Amazon to make a different decision.
Yeah, you can't be quiet when you do these kind of things. They will. No. They're definitely getting a public backlash.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there was one man who has spoken up about an experience he had with a corporation, and I'm sort of wondering if that's going to have an effect on how much it costs him to get cable internet in his house, Miles.
Yes. Cole Marshall is a gentleman who bought an empty lot and was building a house. Now, before he did all of this, he figured out what the address would be for it. He went on to Charter, was his cable company, the cable company of choice at the time. And he signed up saying, okay, let me put in my address. Let me see if it will give service. Oh, look, I can get service. He called up a Charter representative and asked, hey, can I get service if I build my house at this location? Like, yeah, no problem. Okay. He asked again later to get a different person to ask, and they told him the same thing. You can do that. So he buys the lot.
3 points, make a plane. He figures he's safe, right?
Yeah, he builds the house and then goes, all right, I'd like cable internet because he works from home. He needs to have an internet connection. It's an absolute necessity. He can't make a living without that.
Right. It's not just for watching the cat videos.
And Charter goes, oh, actually, you're 0.6 miles away from our network. And to extend out to you is not just laying out an extra little bit of coax. It would actually require a repeater and a lot of hardware and extra backhaul. And that's going to cost about $117,000. And you just need to pay that if you want to get cable internet, because we're not going to pay it.
We're not going to pay for the infrastructure to serve other people in your community.
Right.
We're going to put it all on you.
Yeah. At which point he goes, wait a second. I asked you guys if I could get it before I even bought the lot and before I built the house.
Yeah.
Oh, well, our systems are not necessarily accurate at the moment. They have some errors. We're not going to be held liable for that. To top it all off, after he had been doing this back and forth and trying to find a way to get internet to his house, Charter sent him an advertisement mailed to his house offering the service internet.
Now, can't he just talk to the Better Business Bureau or something? I mean, that sounds like egregious to me.
Wow, and then people might know that Charter's not the best company in the world.
Heavens no.
So he looked at alternatives.
Does he have any recourse?
Yeah, so he looked at alternatives.
Okay.
Not at the moment. He looked at alternatives. One of them was Frontier Communications. And they were telling him, hey, we can provide a package that's 24 megabits. And it's slower than what he wanted for the cable internet, but it's a lot better than nothing.
Yeah.
So he tries to have it set up, but it looks like Frontier won't provide the level at 24 megabits. They'll only give him from about 3 megabits downstream and 1 megabit upstream.
So the advertisements are worth nothing. They're worth nothing.
Absolutely worth nothing. And you know, Comcast is no different. That's our local one. They keep on sending the same ad over and over again for a service they will not give me. It's very frustrating.
Yeah.
And he's not the only one. This also happened to a man. This was covered briefly on the show, a man with Comcast who was trying to get this done and was asking about if AT&T had broadband available. And they're like, oh, yeah, but we'll provide less than a megabit per second. In other words, you can't even watch Netflix on that, let alone run a business.
Bonnie, I want to do a really fast MIT, super fast
camera
story.
Yes, I need some sort of unicorn chaser.
MIT has a camera project which is taking photographs of pulses of light so quickly that they can actually determine the time it's taken from the source to the destination, and therefore they're able to derive how far an object is from just the pulse distance. In any case, the camera and the photographs are fantastic. There's a whole YouTube video about how this works. And I've got to say, I suggest you watch it. You know that famous photograph of an apple being shot by a bullet?
Yeah, it was a sort of like the ta-da example of its time of super fast photography.
Also done at MIT.
Yes.
Also done at MIT. Okay.
Well, the That bullet going through that film, through that, if they use this camera, the super fast camera that they're using now, mm-hmm. to record that entire moment, and then you watched it back at 30 frames per second, it would take you a year to watch the bullet traveling 9 inches.
Whoa.
The camera speed is in a totally different scale than what humans are used to. And yeah. because of that, they're able to show light traveling through liquids and things. Really cool. I highly suggest.
Just amazing. Now, we found out about this from Good Magazine.
Absolutely.
And at that article, does it also link to the NOVA segment?
It does. The NOVA segment's available.
Okay, so that's something to see, guys. You watch that video and you'll have a better sense of what we're talking about here. But basically, super fast photography that is also not exactly just snapping a true shot of what happened, but extrapolating. There's math involved.
Oh, yeah. There's pulses of light that they have to stitch together the entire thing.
Yeah. So you can find out more about that at our website, geekspeak.org. And that does it for the show today. This has been GeekSpeak. And if you'd like to communicate with the show, we do hope that you'll write us either on Twitter or Facebook at KUSPGeeks. We're also geeks@geekspeak.org. And GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So use our stuff, but don't be a jerk about it. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at kusp.org. Do find out about all the stuff we talked about today at our website, geekspeak.org. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Lyle Troxell and Miles Elam. Thank you for listening.